this bitch.
You're listening to the Starkingen Podcast from the StarkingenPost.com. I'm your host, Bill Stark, and you can also find the Starkingen Podcast on TCGPlayer.com, BlackBorder.com, and at MTGCast.com. This week's featured band is PLMB. They're an American band based in France, and PLMB is the former home of New York's Jim Davis. Jim's a prominent East Coast player, as well as making his way as a musician. During the recent Pro Tour Paris, the group got back together with Jim sliding in on bass for a special show during the Pro Tour. You'll hear them throughout the podcast this week, as well as some solo work from Jim. Check the liner notes for more information on the band and how you can become our featured band here in the Starkingen Podcast. The sound of 50 caliber machine gun fire is not what we think of when we consider the background music for the average Magic player's evening. That wasn't the case for Marco Trujillo. Marco is an undergrad at the University of Northern Iowa, where he's studying to be a teacher. In January of this year, he headed for Cairo, Egypt, to finish his student teaching requirement, opting to teach outside of the country in a part of the world he had never been, rather than simply stay near home and teach comfortably. Marco hadn't been in the country for very long when the political situation in the Middle East began to change significantly. In December of 2010, a frustrated street vendor lit himself on fire to protest the regime of President Ben Ali in Tunisia. The act inspired protests across that country, and soon the president was forced into exile. The Arab world took note of the protests, and they spread from Tunisia to many other countries, including Egypt. For Marco, what was to have been a calm student teaching session in a foreign land quickly became anything but. He shared his incredible story with me over the phone.
First of all, why don't you go ahead and tell me, how did you get started with Magic? What was your history with the game?
I learned how to play Magic right after my freshman year at college. I came back to school, or not, to my hometown, Webster City, after my freshman year, and it was about the month of May, and I didn't really have anything going on because it's Webster City, Iowa. And my buddy, who was a couple years older than me, had been playing since he was little, and we were cleaning out his room, and we found his cards. And we got out some of his decks and just tested them out and started playing, and then had a couple long weeks of playing Magic over the summer, and then I left to go to Europe for the summer, and I kind of stopped playing. But when I came back, Magic had kind of like, resurfaced in a group of friends of mine that from their childhood. We all just kind of started playing again, kind of about M10 era, right about then.
In some ways, you're kind of coming back to the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair enough. What level of play would you consider yourself at? Do you play tournaments? Do you mostly play casual events with your friends? Do you play PTQs or things like that?
I'm a pretty casual player. I do some tournaments at, like, Friday Night Magic every couple months, and I do hold drafts with my friends, and we play in a tournament like we have our own draft, which is nice. And that's about it, really. We all have played with casual decks. I don't really consider myself like a pro or anything, but I mean, I do like to play, and I like to collect the cards. And I play probably 10 hours a week on average, I'd say.
Okay, sure. Now, you have a pretty incredible story to tell, really. You somehow found yourself in Egypt during this time of sort of great unrest. How did that come to be?
How did I come to be in Egypt?
Yeah, how did you wind up in Egypt?
Well, I just graduated from UNI in December.
And University of Northern Iowa?
Yep.
And what was your degree?
I was studying to be a teacher. To be an elementary and middle school science teacher. And I was doing my student teaching at an American International School in Cairo for a semester.
And what type of school was that? Was that for Egyptian students? Was it for American expatriates? What type of school was it?
It was open to anybody who could afford it, pretty much, but it was mainly about 75% Egyptian students, and then the rest were a very international crowd. We did have some Americans who their parents were diplomats, and we had a lot of other foreign kids who their parents worked for the embassies in Cairo. And there were also other just other African nations, like they had their prime ministers, their students were at our school, and that's kind of the demographic or makeup of our school. It's pretty diverse, but mostly Egyptian.
Sure. Now, why you're doing your teaching there, was that to finish your curricula, what was required, sort of like student teaching?
Yep, yes. That's exactly what it was.
Why pick Egypt? I mean, there's got to be schools all over the U.S. you could have taught at.
Yeah, I picked Egypt because I had had a friend who did the same thing a year prior, and he really enjoyed it and actually got hired on at the school. So he encouraged me to follow in his footsteps, so I did, and then that's what led me to Egypt. I just had heard a lot of positive things about it and wanted to do the same thing. And I hadn't been to that part of the world yet, so I really wanted to kind of try and see what that was all about.
Sure. And it sounded like you've done some traveling, right? You said you'd been to Europe and kind of around.
Yeah. I got involved with a program my freshman year, the same year I started playing Magic, that allowed me to travel during the winter months and the summer months to Europe and Asia, working on the U.S. military bases, doing child and youth services type things. I ran summer camps for kids during the summertime and did fun camps, winter camps for them during the December and January months. And it was all kind of a really great organization that paid me to travel and run camps on military bases.
What was it like being in Egypt compared to Europe?
Being in Egypt was much more of a third world experience than I had been used to. There was trash on the streets. There were older model cars, no traffic lights or pedestrian crossings. There was just kind of a thin layer of dirt and dust over everything, but mainly being next to the desert. And it was just, I don't know, just to be mean about it, it was dirtier than where I've been in other places in the world, but it was still really great. Just because it was dirty doesn't mean it was kind of gross or unappealing, but it was just kind of like the surface look of Cairo is very dirty, and I wasn't used to that at all.
Sure. What area of Egypt were you in? You said Cairo?
Yep, I was in Cairo.
Now, tell us about what teaching there was like. Was it very challenging? Was it challenging in ways that you didn't expect, or was it exactly what you had kind of anticipated?
It was different than what I anticipated. I had been used to working in American schools in the United States that were funded by the government, and going to Egypt and working in a private school was a lot different. The facilities were nicer. The goal of the school was not, it was not, it was to build character, not solely to educate the students. They wanted to have students to come out of there that knew how to solve problems and that were well-rounded individuals, not so much top-notch scholars. Even though they did offer great, IB programs for high school students, but their main focus or vision of the school was to have a new generation of Egyptian students who were able to kind of work as Americans, have that kind of American mindset.
Sure. Now, were you able to game at all while you were in Egypt? Did you play Magic?
Did
you find people? Yeah? Tell us what that was like.
I was able to be lucky enough to go to Egypt with my roommate at university, and he is also a Magic player, and we both brought three decks and all of our rares kind of with us, and we carried around in a fat pack box, each of us did, and we just kind of duels in our apartment, and we would kind of introduce the game to some other teachers at the school who had heard of it growing up but never really got into it.
So did you introduce other of your coworkers?
Yeah, other faculty members at the school. Some older guys that are about mid to late 20s, early 30s that had always heard of the game, but I don't know, never really bought into it and tested it, but they really seemed to like it a lot.
Were there like Magic players, I guess, indigenous, I suppose, were there local Magic players who were Egyptian or game stores or anything like that, or was that relatively unheard of?
Yeah, it was kind of unheard of. I've been in places in Asia, like Korea and Japan, where whole districts of large cities are devoted to gaming and anime and manga-style cartoons. But in Egypt, there's nothing like that. They had Xbox and PlayStation, but that was about it for gaming. Even puzzle stores and board game stores were hard to come by. I mean, I'm sure I could find them, but there was no Magic anywhere that I could see.
So there were really no gaming stores as we might think of here in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. No comic book stores, really.
You have the opportunity to interact with people, with like local Egyptians to play the game, or did you never get that chance?
I never got to play with any local Egyptians. My social network that I hung around with was mostly school-based, so I met a lot of Canadians and Americans that way, and we would kind of talk to their Egyptian neighbors, but I never really got to hang out with any Egyptians.
So you're there teaching in Egypt. You know, it's kind of, I'm sure, a surreal experience. And then all of a sudden, the incidences in the Middle East start happening, right? Like, we see it first in one country, then another, and Egypt was kind of second on the list. How long had you been in the country when things, the pace of politics started to really pick up there?
It was about the middle of my third week in the country when, I'd say, tensions started to rise. The political unrest started to happen in Egypt. So, and then I got to stay for about 10 more days before I was evacuated out. So I got to see about half of the revolution of Egypt, I guess.
Now, when you say you got to see it, I mean, you're in Cairo, which was kind of a central area for the whole revolution, probably the right word. How close were you? I mean, were you relatively far away from it as a foreigner, or were you close up?
I wasn't close enough to see a lot of the things that Americans saw on CNN, but I was close enough to have a tank outside my apartment building that would fire off its 50 cal gun on top and its big cannon once in a while. I was close enough to hear gunfire all throughout the night for a few nights in a row, and I don't know. I was close enough to be comfortable with it, but I mean, and I was in far enough to not want to be there. So,
what was it like the first time you heard gunfire? Was
right
that
unnerving? Yeah, it was a little bit. One night in particular, the last night I spent in Cairo, was the first time I ever felt really nervous that there was a lot of gunfire that night right down the street from where I was staying, and. But we had just gotten word that our school was going to evacuate us out of the city, kind of get us away from it. Our school had like an evacuation plan if anything bad ever happened, and that had to go into effect. So once I heard that was happening, I kind of got a little nervous to actually be there, but I was never in really any serious danger.
And what makes you certain of that? Did the U.S. Embassy get in touch with Americans in the country and give them a guideline of what they should do to be safe, or were there external factors that made you feel secure? What was it that made you feel like you were relatively safe?
I felt safe because not because of the U.S. Embassy or anything they did, but I did feel safe because of the way the Egyptian people were acting. in the streets during the daytime, it was a very calm atmosphere. There wasn't any anger or hostility, really, unless you were near the protesters. And at night, everywhere you looked, young men and their fathers would be outside guarding their neighborhood block with other neighbors. They would set up roadblocks, so every about quarter mile you had to stop and have your car searched by kind of like a local militia that had popped up all over the city, because there was no law enforcement. The police were gone off the streets. All there was the army, and they couldn't control everything. So to protect their homes and their property from looting in the night, everyone kind of joined neighborhood watch type organizations or clubs and just sat up all night protecting like their own neighborhood, which just made me feel really good.
How did daily life change for you after things started to get a bit hairy? Was it possible to go to the store? I mean, we heard stories of food rationing and things like that. Did you experience that?
There was some kind of, I don't know if we rationed it too well. We kind of went to the store once, bought a lot of, pasta, fish, breads, soups, and water. And we kind of just combined pantries and feasted for 5 days. The group I was with, where there was no food shortages, but we did have a curfew that was in effect that I didn't really like. We weren't allowed, at first we weren't allowed to go out past 7 p.m. by order of the government. And then it drops the next day till 4 p.m. and then to 3 p.m. And not being able to go outside or out into the streets at that time really hindered the way we could go about our lives. And also the fact that they had cut cell phone use and internet use in the country, which totally, it was the biggest bummer ever not to not have the internet or your cell phone for a few days and the internet for even longer.
They cut the internet entirely? The government cut it entirely?
Yep, they cut internet and cell phone use at sometime in the night on a Thursday night. So we went the weekend with no cell phones, and then another like 7 days without internet.
How do you feel at that time? I mean, how did you get information, and how did you feel about what was going on? Did you just not feel like you knew what was happening, or what was it like being without that window to the outside world, so to speak?
Well, I wasn't completely closed off. The place where I was staying, we had a satellite TV dish that we could get most news channels on, not just Al Jazeera and Nile TV that was the local stations, but we also got BBC and CNN worldwide. And also we were able to communicate with other co-workers via landline. They hadn't cut landline, so if you knew a landline number, you could call that. And also, once cell phones were restored, we were able to get incoming calls from the United States and also make outgoing calls. So, and friends and family.
Now, I imagine, I mean, losing cell phone access, I imagine you kind of went dark there, and your family must have been just watching this on television. Were they pretty concerned for your safety during that time?
Yeah, I had even in Egypt, I had heard through the grapevine how worried my mom was getting. All of the parents of people back in the United States kind of created like this calling tree, and if whenever they heard news, it would trickle down. So if another person's parents were contacted, they would kind of tell someone who got through to someone in Egypt. And I had heard that my mom was worrying a lot about me. But when I got back to the United States, she said she was pretty calm and collected. But for the most part, they kind of knew it was out of their hands, and they knew I had a good head on my shoulders, and I wasn't going to get into too much trouble. But I think they're pretty worried.
Sure. I mean, as any mom would be, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So you're there for how many days were you there when the revolution was kind of happening? You said 10, is that right?
What's that?
the revolution had started happening, and you were there for how many days during the political turmoil? You said about 10?
I'd say about 7. I think I left on a... I was there for 8 days during, like, the whole thing of it. About 8 days.
So how did that come to an end? What was the plan there?
How did it all start?
No. How did it end? I mean, you're in the country. Things are kind of going down south. You were evacuated. Is that right? Who got you out, and who was responsible for getting you back home?
I was first evacuated out of the city by the school I was at. I was doing my student teaching at. They had an evac plan they put us on charter buses, all the whole staff, and they bused us 9 hours east across the Sinai Peninsula to the Red Sea, and we stayed in a resort, like an all-inclusive resort, like until further notice is kind of what they did, but they ended up staying there like a week, and I stayed there for 3 days. And then once I was there, we had cell phones back, and we had been in communication with the University of Northern Iowa and our people who are overseeing our student teaching. They had been contacted by a state senator of Iowa, Senator Grassley, and by the president of our university, kind of urging us that it's time for us to come home. They're kind of our responsibility as long as we're taking, we're still kind of enrolled at UNI as part of our student teaching. So they were responsible for our well-being, and I don't think they liked the idea that we were in a country that was going through a revolution. So they got us plane tickets and flew us home as soon as they could. Flew us out of the resort town we were staying in that was called Sharm El Sheikh. That's on the Red Sea.
This is where President Mubarak eventually retired to, I believe.
Yeah, Barak has a big palace in Sharm El Sheikh. I actually drove by it when I was on my way to the airport, and it's a pretty big compound that he's got there.
Okay, so you were flown back home. How did you feel about the political strife kind of when you got back? Did you feel happy for the Egyptians who were involved with it? Were you a Mubarak supporter? Like, kind of, what was your stance on things?
I wouldn't say I was a Mubarak supporter, but I did follow the news quite a bit when I got back, and the first feeling I had was I was upset at how it was being portrayed in the United States media. I had been so used to seeing BBC and like more worldwide news channels in Egypt, and they kind of focused on the wrong parts of the story in the United States, and I didn't like that at all. But
like, what element do you feel they focused on?
They focused on, because I came home on the day where all of those pro-Mubarak supporters came riding into the city on like camels and with swords and things like that. Like, I left Egypt on that day. And so I was in the airport in Europe, and I flew first to Saudi Arabia, then to Europe. And when I was in Saudi Arabia is when I saw all that happening. And then when I got to Europe, I kind of figured out why it happened. And then when I got to the United States, that's all they talk about is how out of control these protesters are getting. And I was just thinking to myself that it's not like that. It was like the most peaceful protest I'd seen, and the only reason it got out of control is because these pro-Mubarak jerks came in and started hurting people, and it just kind of, I don't know, brought this dark cloud over the whole this beautiful thing that was happening in Egypt.
Would you say that overall, then, you're happy with how the situation has resolved itself so far, or do you still have regrets or concerns about how things have gone?
I feel good about what's happened. I'm actually planning on returning to Egypt in the fall. I got a job offer at the school I was student teaching at, so I'm going to be there at the end of August, and I'll be there for the September elections that are supposed to take place. and I'm a little nervous for what's going to happen there, but I'm really excited to see what kind of direction the country goes in and what kind of leadership they can get in front of them. Because there's a lot of people in that country that are looking, you know, to improve, like, their situation and improve the quality of life in Egypt. So I'm just excited to see where that's going to go.
Pretty amazing. Apparently, it sounds like being there and seeing it all really impacted you for your willingness to go back.
Yeah, it really did. Having Egyptian students and being able to speak with them on a daily basis about, I mean, they were only in fourth grade, but even at 10, 11 years old, they do have an opinion on what goes on in their country, and they hear what their parents talk about at home. But these kids kind of would talk to me about what's going on, and they agreed that a president shouldn't be in power that long, and that steps towards progress need to be made, and that it was time for a change. So that's kind of the stance I took on it as well.
Sure. I guess my final question, Marco, it's a really incredible story. It's just unbelievable and an amazing set of circumstances that led for our paths across the event. But I guess my final question for you then would be, what is your sort of comment for, you know, Magic players and Americans and Europeans, I guess, at large, listening to the podcast about things in Egypt, the Egyptian people? What's kind of your overall reaction, and what's the one thing that you would tell them?
I guess I would tell them that it's important to step outside of your comfort zone and go and see. It's not another country, another part of the world that you haven't been to before, and just see what it's like to live in the complete opposite normal or the norm that you're used to. It'll really open your eyes and make you have a greater understanding of what goes on every day outside of your little bubble.
That'll do it for us this week. I'd like to thank Marco Trujillo for spending the time to share his story with us. It's truly an incredible tale. I'd also like to thank Jim Davis and PLMB for being our featured band this week. For more information on how you can become our featured band here in the Stark New Podcast, check contact information in the liner notes, and make sure to check out How to See More from Jim and PLMB in the liner notes as well. All content here in the Starkington Podcast is copyright thestarkingtonpost.com. If you'd like information on how you can feature the Starkington Podcast on your site or blog for free, contact us via email or through the website. Thanks for listening this week, and make sure to check us out in addition to daily news updates, articles, and more on thestarkingtonpost.com. Now, here's Jim Davis to take us home.